Okay, so we'll start off with a question from Will Davis, who is one of our he now lives in California, Hollywood, but however he has a question for us. He said, okay, it's a slightly long question. I'm going to rattle through it. There is a point beyond which philosophy, if it is not to lose face, must turn into something else, performance. It has to pass a test in a foreign land, a territory that's not its own. For the ultimate testing of our philosophy takes place not in the sphere of strictly rational procedures, writing, teaching, lecturing, but elsewhere, in the fierce confrontation with death of the animal that we are. The worthiness of one's philosophy reveals itself, if anywhere, in the live performance of one's encounter with one's own death. That's how we find out whether it is of some substance or it is all futility. Tell me how you deal with your fear of annihilation and I will tell you about your philosophy. thanks very much, Will.
Does he say where that quotation is from?
No.
Is it a quotation?
It is, yeah. It does seem to be a quote. He found it on the internet.
The whole thing.
He was, yeah.
Put it back in the internet and be able to tell you.
I realise this is as much of a statement as it is a question, yeah. But I would be very interested in the panel's thoughts. Okay, so I'll pass straight over to Paramananda.
Pass.
I don't really know what he's asking. Well, he's not really asking anything, isn't he? What's the asking of? What we make of our
tell me
death.
How you deal with your fear of annihilation?
I don't know, actually. I mean, one thing that struck me, one thing that comes to my mind is that when I became a father, I suddenly experienced a lot more existential fear than I ever had before. So in a way, I don't know that I've ever been particularly disturbed by the idea of my own annihilation. You know, I don't feel that I particularly struggle with the fact that I'm going to die. But I do think he's right in that I think it, all our practice as Buddhists, one's practice is towards death, if not a literal death, but a symbolic death. We practice towards death, and I think unless that's there, there isn't really any authenticity in practice. I would agree with that, you know. I mean, that's an idea that's quite sort of prevalent in the Western philosophical tradition, I think, as much as Buddhism, you know. But I do try and think about it, I suppose. I try and have a sense of my own mortality, you know. But I don't know what else to say about it, really.
Kavishri?
Yes, it's interesting, because I read the questions when I turned up here this evening, and I've been thinking about this question a bit, and I don't know, maybe like you, maybe not Paramananda, but I think I tend to be a nihilist, so I tend to sort of I'm quite relieved that we're going to die in a way, I think, you know, I don't want to go on living forever, actually, so but I realise what I am frightened of, I think, actually, rather than death is dying itself, the fact that might be quite long, might be protracted, I don't know what sort of suffering there will be in that. I think the idea that I will be dead and I won't be here, I'm sure once that's sort of staring me in the face, there will be fear, but at the moment, yeah, I don't feel particularly frightened of not being here. I think it's more dying and not knowing how I will die. And also I think it's other people's death that frightens me. Actually, it's thinking about my loved ones dying and being dead And not having control over that, I suppose. Not maybe being able to alleviate their suffering. And yeah, I think that fills me with quite a lot of fear, actually. So, yeah, I think that's all I can say. Really.
Okay, Ron, Robert.
Well, when my father died, I was very close to my father, and the grief was a very strong sense of grief, and the sense of also the finality of it, because I kept on dreaming that he was still alive. This went on for, it went on for about 2 years, although it gradually got less and less. So I'd keep on dreaming that it was a mistake, and I'd be very pleased to see it, and then I'd wake up and realize, oh no, this really is true. So there's that finality, that absolute truth of the fact that he'd gone, really hit me very strongly. And it almost felt like a clean truth somehow. Like it was so definite that he wasn't there anymore. Like I said, there was no question about it. No amount of wishful thinking on my part could change it. You know, if you fall out with a friend, you can sort of think, oh, maybe it's all right, maybe we can get back together. But in that case, I couldn't get him back at all. You know, I knew that. And so that it was something almost refreshingly clean about the finality and reality of that. And it did affect the way I did meditations on death. There's one meditation on death, or at least it's partly on death, called the Six Element Practice, where you go through your own experience, your experience of yourself, in terms of your solidity, the liquids that's in you, the air that's in you, the energy and fire that's in you, and the space that you occupy, and finally the awareness that is holding all that together in a way. And one of the ways of doing that meditation is to actually imagine one by one those elements being returned to their equivalents in the outside world. So just imagining if you were buried in the ground, if I was buried in the ground, just imagining the fact that everything solid about me would gradually become assimilated and less distinguishable from the rest of the earth, you know. I almost quite enjoyed doing that. It's sort of almost a lurid thing, maybe. I don't know if I feel proud of that, but just sit there and imagine that process. What an extraordinary thing. And it was very difficult somehow also to believe it. Look down at your own knee and think, it's going to rot one day. That's really strange. Sorry to say this, but I hope you don't mind me mentioning it. And so I think to some extent it shows that I haven't yet quite got it. And there was a time, actually even before my father died, when I thought, I'm no longer afraid of death. And I think, again, that was a slightly premature response. It's as if I've now discovered, you know, the problem of death on another level in a way. It's definitely still there. But I think one thing I do have is the sense that Dharma practice does seem to be an approach to it. It does seem to make quite a difference. It's not that there is an answer which you've got to believe. It's more that it's an approach to confronting the reality of death. And to some extent, the very common belief in rebirth that you get in Buddhism is almost a cop-out, in a sense. You know, it's like, I'm not saying it is for everybody, but if it's taken too literally, it almost gives you an excuse not to have to worry about it, because you imagine you're going to carry on, which is a misunderstanding, because that's not what the Buddha said. He didn't say you're going to carry on. He says something may carry on, but it's not you. So, I think that's enough.
Yes.
Okay. I think we all got the emphasis slightly wrong in the... I mean, I'm done here because I find Buddhism enormously life-affirming. And the great Scottish writer, Sir Walter Scott, on his deathbed, said to his son something like, the only thing that will comfort you when you come to lie here is the knowledge of a good and just life. Oh, yeah. And the time I first heard that, I didn't really make much of it. But I have now found, through the meditation and the Buddhist morality and attempting to apply it all, that I actually have a tremendous sense of confidence in whatever is going to happen. And I mean, you know, one's dying is normally controlled by drugs or something, hopefully not too painful. So then you're just going to go and push up daisies. And that's all right. I'm quite happy with the idea of
even a garden, little flowers popping on. So I think it's a much more positive approach than Will's allowing himself to see. Or something like that.
Okay.
I agree with the positive. Rather than fearing death itself, for me it's more time running out and death just being a reminder of constantly questioning what you're doing and your choices and are you being true to yourself and how you're treating other people. I think that's how I personally fear death more, as a concept of time running out, I think.
I think those two points I think make a very good point, which is it does seem to be about how the way that you live your life does seem to be the kind of key thing, really. Where are you going to sit?
I don't know. I was going to say something, but I'm not.
Okay,
David. I'm coming from this side of the room too. In that, this guy is talking about basically the test of your own philosophy, or the test of a philosophy is evaluated through death.
So how you approach death.
How are you? I don't know, I'm not sure. But anyhow, that's how I read it. And from a Buddhist perspective, obviously, we're all dying. you may care to acknowledge that or not, but if you do, Buddhistically speaking, I think, that's considered to be one of the main motivators to going to refuge, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And everything that kind of, means to you. It's a very intimate relationship that, anyone can have with his own. And anybody, with his own death particularly, which I think is what this guy was talking about. I don't think he was talking about death in general, I think he was talking about one's own death.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Thanks, Devin.
Just a quick point, really, because I'm probably quite strange in that I deal with a lot of dead people, because I do medicine, I chop up a lot of dead bodies, and my part-time job is to create prostheses.
To create what?
Prostheses, like I have to cut the arm perfectly so you can see all the bits, all the layers of the fascia and things like that. And also I see a lot of death because I work in sometimes A&E and you will sometimes just happen to be in the room and someone dies. And I feel very much the beginning of my life. But when you deal with a lot of dead bodies and a lot of people dying, it's strangely... I think we become so detached from it in our culture. But there's something so powerful about seeing how the body just is a complete vessel. There's nothing there. When you deal with an actual dead person, their character is sort of shadowed in their body. Like, you'll see that they smoked, their lungs are black and things like that. And it makes me feel like the... something we don't get about death, I think, is that I feel very kind of positive when I see that this person must have lived and all the marks on their body that they've had, and that you really do get one chance at it. And it's nothing to fear at all, it's to be embraced. And if we embraced our own mortality more, we'd be better people. And we'd live in a more kind of conscious way, I think. I don't think we're in touch enough. I think we try and ignore that we're going to die a lot of the time.
We don't even have dead animals hanging up in butchers anymore, hardly, do we? I mean, I'd agree with what you said. I worked in a hospice for quite a long time, and Well, it's a bit like what Ratna Prabhu was saying, that when someone's dead, it's very definite, isn't it? There's something, you know, there's something very, she was saying, very final about it.
But it isn't sad, though, is it?
No.
It's not sad.
No, it's sad. Well, it can be.
Yeah.
I was always struck actually. The woman that was ahead, I worked in the Zen hospice, and the woman who was head of the volunteer program had worked there for years and years and years, and she was absolutely fantastic woman, and you know, everybody like really respected her. And I don't know how many people she sort of helped die, but when her own mother died, I mean, she pieces, so it's quite different, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know.
It's people you leave behind.
Well, it seems to me that the question is really about what the responses say about one's philosophy, and I suppose in the Buddhist tradition, the philosophy relates to letting go. So, dying is about, I suppose the right way to die in Buddhist philosophy is being able to let go. So I'm just wondering how people's responses address that, the letting go aspect of Buddhist philosophy.
I think that's one reason I mentioned that practice, the six element practice, because it is a sort of a training in letting go. And one way you can break letting go down is rather than just saying, I'm going to let everything go all at once, which I suppose you have to, like a hand of death, is you sort of try to let it go little bits at a time. And you could do it in terms of, you know, letting go of biscuits for a week or something. But you could also do it in that almost dramatic way of imagining letting go of your breath, for example. Mm-hmm. So as you breathe out, you have a sense of, I'm now just completely releasing that, and that the next moment hasn't come yet, you know, and the receiving of the next breath is not contingent on the letting go of the previous breath. The letting go of the previous breath is just gone. There it is, it's gone. And it's gone into the atmosphere. It's joined the whole of the atmosphere. It's an extraordinary thought, really, the fact that there isn't anything that actually really belongs to us in our body. There's nothing special about the air in my lungs. You couldn't tell that the air in my lungs was mine by any means, you know. But yet, I identify with this body and with this awareness and the other mental factors. And it's a very strange, very, very strange thing.
Do you want us to say something about letting go? Would you like to say something? On a more personal level, I suppose, I've got a friend who's terminally ill with cancer, and 2 years ago, she was given 3 years to live. And there's a book called, it's going to go completely out of my head now, a Stephen Levine book called A Year to Live. And it's written particularly for people who are facing death. But at the back, I'm feeling a bit upset actually. He goes through like a monthly program that you could do. So you could do this over a year. And I've been doing that with her and with another friend for a year. And obviously I'm in a different situation to her. You know, although I could die tomorrow, it's not as real to me as her being told that she's got terminal cancer. And I guess what I've been trying to do in that, a lot of the exercises are about letting go, really. But I think they're very much about letting go of the past, actually. So there's an awful lot about relationships and resentments. And trying to sort things out with people, or if I feel that I've done something that I'm ashamed of, to actually go and talk to the person about that. And I think the idea is really that it brings you up to the present, in a way. But I mean, it's been quite interesting for me, because in that year, I've got ordained, all sorts of things that have happened to me that have made me project into the future quite a lot. And I suppose I also realise that I think we need to do that, actually. That, you know, it's great to be in the present moment, but actually, you know, I'm still young, I've got my life ahead of me, it's quite natural that I project into the future. And I think for her, that's one of her losses, I suppose, that's what she's trying to let go of. But at the same time, she doesn't know when she's going to die either, so... So I suppose that's sort of letting go on a more emotional level, really. And I think those things come up anyway, don't they? Like if you go on a retreat, I know for me that's often when I realise, oh, there's something unresolved with somebody that I need to address, or there's something actually that I regret that just keeps bothering me in meditation that I need to do something about. So.
Also, maybe, I've never really thought of it like this before, but I think one of the things that makes death, especially when we're talking about somebody who you care about or know, so, the sort of the painfulness of it is, I think it might be related to the shock of it all. I think the shock is, like, you know, seeing... somebody, you know, death is like, it is a sudden process, the actual turning the light off. And I think that is one of the things that perhaps causes a lot of the pain, because you do come to get used to that person being dead, and that person, and that pain does diminish in time once you get to know a new reality vis-a-vis of that person. And I think a lot of the suffering is due to the shock, you know, in part anyhow, to the shock of it, rather than to, you know, perhaps the actual death of if you see what I mean. I don't know what to... It's just an idea.
I mean, one thing I feel quite strong about, actually, my father died when I was 22. And I feel my relationship's very much continued with him. And I'm now some years older than he ever was. But I think significant people remain in your psyche. So yes, they're dead. But as kind of psychic entities, your relationship with them still evolves and changes. And I feel I've got a very different relationship to my father now as a 56-year-old man than I did as a 22-year-old man, you know? So in a way it's very final, but as an internal psychic process it continues, you know, very much so, I think. There, you know. In your imagination, in your unconscious, whatever you want to call it, they remain. So, you know, and I feel that quite strongly, that with significant people, that, you know, that relationship remains alive, and that's a very positive thing, that it remains alive, you know. That's my experience.
Good. Death is a very rich and complex field of contemplation, if you like, particularly for Buddhists. You know, it's a particularly sort of Buddhist kind of mystery, if you like. Or yeah. So it's been good to give that question a bit of time. So the next question is from David over there. I would like to hear some views about the importance or otherwise of things coming to us in meditation that seems significant. Little insights, especially of a psychological or therapeutic nature. Is that
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
It's clear.
Okay. What?
Oh, no.
Carve. What did you want to carve your shrine?
It's tied in the middle, yeah.
Well, it's not quite clear enough for me, actually, David. I mean, I can answer it, but I just wondered if there was something there from you, because I just wonder if you're thinking particularly about things that have been significant in your meditation, or if it is just a more general question. That's all.
Well, the way it was structured is fairly accurate, but when I said the importance of things that come to you, and then I sent an email to Jananda and I said I meant the sort of therapeutic importance of things that come to you or perhaps other types of important, you know. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm concerned, in view of the insights and things that come to me, in meditation, I wonder sort of how much one needs to hold them, or perhaps let go of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For instance,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, insights and things. Are they? You know, is it something that, you know, how, Is there a therapeutic importance, and what is that therapeutic importance of insights and things that can come to you, and what, you know, is there some kind of way that we should address these things in view of it?
Okay, so yeah, from my experience, actually, two quite separate things, maybe. So one is, actually, I don't know, yeah. Don't want to say that. Well, I suppose through my meditation, I've certainly been able to face particularly difficult feelings that arise in me from things that happened in my childhood that are quite, you know, quite traumatic emotions, basically, that I haven't really been able to access in therapy. I think because I think I can be quite clever with words. So I think in therapy, in a talking therapy, I'm somehow actually always controlling what I'm saying to some extent. That's my sense of it. I don't really let my guard down. Something happens in meditation, or can happen, at a deeper level, actually. I think more when I'm in touch with the body, and emotions can come up in a sort of felt sense, rather than there being a lot of story or thought. And I think over the years, I've become braver and braver at being with those sort of experiences, and it's actually been quite liberating. Certain emotions I've been quite frightened of in the past. So that's sort of ongoing. So that's one thing. And I also teach mindfulness-based cognitive therapy in Brighton. And I mean, I think that's very much about actually being with states that we've been avoiding. So I think it can have a therapeutic role. But then the other thing is just to say, you know, images can come to me in meditation as well, which I think are mysterious. And that's when I don't, like you say, I don't necessarily run with those too much, because I think personally I can get involved in a lot of navel gazing and how interesting I am, and I think there's a limit to that. But for me, when images
of, what do you mean?
Because I suppose I feel like I'm meditating to liberate myself ultimately from a sense of self, not to just develop myself, if you see what I mean. For me, my path, I don't feel, is just psychological. It goes beyond that. It's transcendental. So although I can have lots of interesting psychological insights in meditation, and I am interested in that, I also feel there's a limit to that as well. Or I want to go further than that, if you see what I mean. I know I could go on a retreat, have a strong experience in meditation, and get very caught up in that, and it's very interesting, and it's true, it is. But there's something beyond that, I suppose. So, yeah, so maybe that's enough for now. Sorry, I just suddenly, when I thought, am I going to say this, I suddenly realised I don't really know people here very well. But, anyway. It's all right, isn't it?
Thanks, Kav. Kavishu, that's, yes, thank you, yeah. Paramanda?
Well, I've got quite strong feelings about this, really, I suppose. And I think, you know, you're trying to abide with what's happening when you meditate. So you're kind of interested in what happens, you know. But I think, you know, what Kavishu is saying in a way, I think you should be abiding with what goes happening, but once you start trying to make anything of them, I think basically what you're doing is trying to impose a meaning on them. So the ego appropriates the image. You know, I'd call it all image. So if you got, I think the distinction I'd make is that you can sit in meditation and fantasize, which is something that you can feel that you're somehow confecting it, that you're making it happen. You're often a fantasy. And I don't think that's very useful at all. But I think if you're just doing meditation and stuff presents itself to you, I think they should always be noticed. I think that material is always worth noticing. But ideally, and this is to borrow a James Hillman phrase, you stay with the image. You don't try and impose a meaning on it. So you don't say, oh, that means blah, blah, blah. So you're not trying to reduce it to a psychological insight, actually. You're trying to abide with it as a product of your, what we might call, psyche, you know. Big subject, but I mean, I think that's a very important part of meditating personally. And I think the other significant thing from a meditative point of view, I'd associate all that with what I broadly term body. So it's arising out of the body, and I don't particularly mean the physical body, but a much more general idea of the body, which includes a kind of psychic body. So it's everything that's actually below the sort of ego, in a sense, you know. And I think that material arising out is a very important aspect of meditation, you know. But it's very difficult not to get caught up in it in a particular way, and that's the sort of art of meditating, really, I think. Yeah. But it's very difficult and more or less impossible to do that. But I think that's what we're looking for. Anyway, it's a big area, a very interesting area, I think.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, is there anyone, does anyone have any kind of immediate response? Nikolai?
I was just going to say, I guess it, for me anyway, it depends what context I'm in. If I'm on retreat and everything's calmed down, I'm a bit more sensitive. I can tell what's kind of relevant or important and what's just froth from the day before or the week before. And if I find it on retreat anyway, I find it a bit more easy to see what's significant and what's worth reflecting on afterwards.
I think that's a very good point. When you do need some sort of samatha there first, whatever you want to call it, you need some sort of grounding samatha for that to be a useful thing to do.
Okay, David, do you want to answer your own question?
Yes, I've answered my own question, but like, because it seems that I've had a little insight. And what you were talking about, about therapy and talking and stuff, I think that the things that, you know, that come to you that one might consider important are things that perhaps we haven't really, you know, through kinds of ways that we behave and position ourselves in life and so on and think and let ourselves feel and not feel and so on. I think meditation can sort of open you up to sort of feel things that kind of integrate you, and it's a kind of integrative process at times, these things that come, and in that sense I would presume that they're very important, therapeutically speaking, and then one feels more one with oneself, then you can move forward and transcend oneself, but it's very difficult to do much if you feel that there's like a part of you like that's stifled or missing through whatever reason. And I think meditation with me has given, I've had a few little insights that have come that have been like sort of integrative a little bit.
Okay, Prabhu?
No, I haven't got anything to add.
Right, okay. Anyone else have anything to say? Just Richard.
Just very briefly, because over the years I've had a number of experiences in meditation. I'm not really talking about psychological aspects, but a whole range of them. And I was talking to Carl Sheila about this recently, and he says, well, it's important to entrust the process, not the product. Which is, you know, you have a process in the sense an unfolding of yourself, you gradually come to know yourself. But don't take necessarily the end, you know, get caught up in the end result, because they're only provisional. You know, you will probably, if you're spiritual practice is developing, they will develop. So don't get caught up really and you've got this big insight and it's going to govern and rule your life now and all the rest. Don't get caught up in it, basically.
Thank you. Any further comments on that? No? Good. Thank you very much. So our third question comes from, it's a very different question, different area. It comes from Jonathan Fruin. His question is, Buddhism seems to be a fairly solitary affair. Does it allow for much family life? How do new children come into the equation? Right. I should say, Jonathan has actually just had a little girl. So he's just, he and his wife, of course, a little girl, she's called Ivy. And, so obviously, you know, he's got this new arrival, and, out of this comes this question, because he's now, you know, in this family thing. Yeah. Buddhism seems to be a fairly solitary affair. Does it allow for much family life? How do new children come into the equation? Rather.
I don't have any children, so I don't really have any personal. I think for non-parents to advise parents is a very, very dodgy thing, actually. I'm not sure I want to do it myself.
Okay. Okay. Can't be true. All right, okay. Paramananda.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it is a solitary affair at all. But, I mean, there's two questions there, isn't there? There's one about is Buddhism a solitary affair, which I would totally disagree with, you know, and as you pointed out downstairs this evening, the Sangha is one of the three jewels. I mean, Buddhism's always emphasize community and collective practice, be that not necessarily in a family context, but you know, it's always emphasized the importance of collective practice. And I feel that more and more strongly when we go away on retreat or something, or when we meditate together, we can directly express a sense of altruism by practicing together in a very tangible, real way. As for kids, I mean, I think I've made quite a conscious decision. I don't I don't want to bring up my son as a Buddhist, you know. As I wouldn't, you know, I appreciate the fact that my parents didn't bring me up in a particular religion. And I didn't have that, you know, I felt. I mean, I'm very happy. I mean, he knows what I do, and he's sort of kind of interested. And as an eight-year-old, if you asked him, he'd probably say he was a Buddhist, but I certainly haven't. I mean, in a way, I've consciously made sure that as far as possible, except through direct example, I haven't tried to indoctrinate him as a Buddhist, you know. I think indoctrination is indoctrination. Whatever it is, you're indoctrinating, you know. So, I think Sangharakshita has been very clear about this. You can't be a born Buddhist, really, in his, you know, his way of looking at it. Of course, there's a lot of people that are born Buddhist, but I mean, I don't know in reality whether you can be a born Buddhist. It's something that you do. It's a commitment you make out of your own free will, you know. So I don't know. But I mean, obviously, as a parent, you can try and practice the precepts towards your children, can't you? You know. Bring them up with loving kindness. But I mean, I presume that all parents want to do that, whether they're Buddhist or anything else. You know. It's a bit mad. It's a bit mad.
Being practically, it's quite difficult to do any education and talk. It's actually, I think, a lot of it is just to do with actually keeping up any kind of practice.
Well, it is a practice bringing out a kid, isn't it? Yeah. I think you need to broaden
Has to come together. And I think the question is really saying, is some kind of spirit, any kind of spiritual practice really, how does that relate to the reality of bringing up children? Because I think that's like saying a spiritual practice is separate from your life, which it isn't. But you might not be able to carry on in the usual way when you have children. You have to find another way of
doing it. I do remember Sri Mala telling me when her two little girls were very small how, in a way, her meditation practice actually improved. And the reason was that she managed to get 3/4 of an hour a day when her husband or mother or mother-in-law or something was looking after the children. And it was so precious to her, that little slot that was just for her, that she really used it well, you know. Well, before that, and with her other single friends looking at them, she said, well, in a way they could meditate when they wanted, you know, they could just... And so the effort wasn't going into it, you know. I think she said she benefited a lot from that. I mean, quite apart, as you say, from the whole area of the children themselves.
Well, maybe there's room for a practical guide to keeping up that side of it.
I think one thing which, you know, would be great in a Sangha like this is, in a way, little self-help groups, say, of people who've got small children. So that practically speaking, they can help each other out, you know, but also they can actually just talk over things like, how do you deal with particular things that come up.
Of course, you know,
they're
teenagers.
Yeah. And how do you tell? What if you've lost a lot of sleep, for example? How do you practice if you've lost a lot of sleep? Yeah,
I think one has to be careful not to, you know, say, how do you practice? Well, you know, there's a lot more to practice than meditate, isn't there? You know, I think a lot of I think most parents would say, it's a very profound practice trying to bring up a kid.
I've got a
Buddhist, you know. I mean, that's certainly my experience with trying to bring up a child. It's a lot more challenging than sitting on a cushion. You know, we're talking about practice. I'm not saying sitting on a cushion isn't important, but, you know, I think there's loads of scope of practice. You just kind of open up what you regard as practice, you know. Certainly practice patience.
Yeah, I'd echo that. I'm teaching two mums of young boys at the moment in Brighton on a meditation course, and they've both been getting frustrated because they can't sit down, you know, with a CD and do a sit. And yet when they talk in the class about what they have been doing, you know, one of them was saying, oh God, I was reduced to doing it in the passenger seat of the car on the way to Legoland. You know, and I said, well, I think that's fantastically creative.
Legoland,
you know. But, you know, she's practicing when she can, and I think it's made her very creative, and I mean, the other thing is, I've been at the Brighton Centre for 16 years now, and about 16 years ago, two of the women there who were very involved had children, and so what they did was they set up a creche, so there was a Thursday morning drop-in, and they ran the creche for that, and then they took it in turns to run the creche, so actually they were freeing each other up to come to that meditation. And I think it needs that, actually. Yeah. I think it needs that more than just a self-help group. I do think the Sangha has to create opportunities for families to get involved, but I think it's one of those things where actually the families have to do it themselves. You know, it's like, unfortunately, there aren't the resources for there to be somebody here to set things up for families. So if there's a gap there that you want filled, you know, you need to do it yourself. And they've done that in Brighton, and they've had family retreats at Rivendell, lovely retreat centre, every August now for about 16 years. There's quite a strong family sangha there, which, I mean, I don't know how satisfying people find that, how helpful they find it for the practice, but, you know, there is that connection. And on the family retreat, they have volunteers that look after the kids. So the parents very much have it as a retreat, and they go and meditate. So, yeah.
Well, I'm not a parent, but the Brahma Kumaris have a chain of shops, and they sell really lovely books full of meditations for children with lovely pictures. Mm. And I've bought a couple for my nephew when he goes to bed, and I gave some to my cousin who's got three little girls, and they find them wonderful. They you know, imagine themselves in all different situations, and then at the end of it they have to wiggle their fingers and toes. And they're just lovely meditations. But also I have a piano pupil who, the minute something gets a little bit hard, she gives up. So I gave her this meditation that Lama Yeshe gave me to strengthen the mind. And I told her to do it for 5 minutes every morning. She's 13, so I said that when she gets to 14, she needs to build, with every year, she needs to build it up for 5 minutes. But so she does 5 minutes a day when she gets up in the morning. And the meditation is being with your breath. The seven breaths, noticing when you're breathing in, noticing when you're breathing out, and noticing in between the breaths, and then stopping and watching your thoughts. And when a thought comes, you just let it go as if you're opening your hand and allowing a butterfly to just fly away. And when your mind wanders, you go back to the counting of the breaths. So just 5 minutes a day, and I find that she's not giving up so easily anymore, which is strengthening the mind. And I feel that, you know, if I had some responsibility for children, if I adopted children, I would want them to learn to this kind of meditation as early as possible, because I think a strong mind is the most precious thing that anyone can have. That's my opinion.
Meditation is a way of the secular thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, that meditation happens to be based on, you know, many traditions have meditation. It's slightly different from Buddhist on that as a Buddhist. You know, there's nothing exclusively Buddhist about meditation.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, I've got a friend of mine who's just had a kid. And, I was thinking about myself, you know, because you get to a certain age, and then there's kind of roots that life, you're always supposed to do this, and, you know, parents will say, oh, when this happens, blah, blah, blah. And just on a very practical level with him, he's really struggling to kind of, A, make ends meet. He's working every hour of the day, he's looking after his kid, he just has no time to himself at all, you know. And just on a personal level, I thought if I had a kid now, I'd be in exactly the same position. It would really, I'd have no time to meditate, I'd have no real time to kind of, and maybe it's just a personal thing about me, I feel like if I couldn't have sufficient time to engage, put everything behind my practice, I'm pretty sure I'd start drifting in, you know, at this point in my life anyway, I'd start drifting away from it quite significantly.
I think it all comes out right in the end, though. you know. I mean, you go through this, if you go, you know, if you had a child, you would look after a child, and it's difficult, but then it passes, and then you know, and that experience will feed in. It must do.
Yeah.
It's on somewhere, wasn't it? I thought.
Yeah.
Whatever happens in your life, you practice with, don't you? So.
Something that's never discussed, actually, it's a lot of religions emphasise like having celibacy, and actually sex and relationships and children distract you from a goal, you know, whatever that goal is, enlightenment, blah, blah, blah. Probably because you'd have no time to do anything, and you're sleep deprived and you're stressed, or you're in love and you have a heartache, all the things. But Buddhism never talks about that. Oh, does it? Oh, I've never heard of it. And I'm always like, what does Buddhism think about that?
Well, it's a very central idea going forth from a family life. That's what the Buddha did.
Yeah.
That's a very central idea of Buddhism.
Yeah. I thought you were here for my talk last week, right?
No, I was going to do it before. No, did you actually completely answer that last week?
Yeah. Well, I gave a talk on gender and sexuality in Buddhism.
Oh, I wasn't.
And part of that talk was on celibacy. Yeah.
On the web.
It's on the web. Yeah.
So the gist is that it is a distraction, or it isn't a distraction.
Right. Okay. Does anyone want to answer that, Paramahansa?
Answer what?
Is it or is it not?
Is what?
Some religions
see what?
Sex, relationships, children, family, anything that's not you meditating and focusing.